Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Princess Yachts, the UK's leading luxury yacht manufacturer, proud sponsors of Motorsport's Formula One coverage.
So without further ado, please welcome onto the stage Damon Hill, a patron of Halo, and Karun Chandok, a patron of VDCT.
Hello.
Right, I probably undersold you a bit there, didn't I? I didn't mention that you were world champion.
Or indeed,
was it 1983 you won the Champion of Brands on a Yamaha TZ something?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I think it was 83.
Champion
yeah.
on two wheels and four, John Surtees, basically.
Well, it was only the Champion of Brands. Mm-hmm. It wasn't the World Championship or the Isle of Man TT or whatever else that John won. Fair. Because he did have he was the top of the... top of the field, wasn't he?
Completely. He was.
In both categories.
And I also failed to mention that Karun, who had a fleeting Grand Prix career with a couple of rubbish teams.
They were.
It's not unfair, is it? You became a father relatively recently, and the first thing you did after that was to go off and race a McLaren M1 at Goodwood.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's...
But you did win.
I did, but still, please. Thanks.
You got
thanks, Dad.
You got sparkling.
Well, that's fine.
Also, there's lipstick on that one.
Okay, that's mine.
Hang on a second. That's yours, is it?
Yeah.
Right. Well, we'll change lipstick. That. We'll start again.
It's his first birthday tomorrow, so that's gone pretty quickly.
But racing a McLaren at Goodwood, that's pretty special, isn't it?
It was, yeah. It got a little bit awkward when one of the marshals came to my wife, and she was 5 or 6 months pregnant at the time. And this is the year before, and the marshal came to my wife and said, "Do you know this car's called the Widowmaker?"
Oh, sure.
And then proceeded to tell her the story of Bruce McLaren's accident at Goodwood in a Can-Am McLaren as I was getting in the car, which was not the best idea, but celebrity.
Right, we're here to talk about the 2019 Formula One season. Let's move on to that. The format, basically, we'll chat, talk nonsense for 45 minutes or so, and then there'll be an opportunity for you guys to ask sensible questions for 15 or 20 minutes after that. Did we see peak Lewis Hamilton this year?
Can I just ask one question before you get on to that? Did we make a prediction in March as to what would happen? Do you remember what it was?
I meant to watch it online.
Okay,
and
we'll
forgot.
Get to that in a minute.
Well, I'm pretty sure you all said that Lewis was going to be world champion.
No prize there, eh?
Yeah. And you also predicted that Red Bull and Honda would win races.
Ah, yeah, that's good.
And you said very correctly that Pierre Gasly would be crap against Max Verstappen.
We're good. We should be on TV doing this stuff.
It's a little bit harsh.
Should be, yeah.
It's a bit harsh, isn't it?
I didn't say it was going to be crap.
And he finished brilliantly.
And he was brilliant at the Toro Rosso.
Well, but that's weird, isn't it? He's supposed to go fast in the fast car, but he goes fast in the slow car. We'll get on to that.
Right, okay, go on. Are we hijacking your plan?
Only slightly.
Oh, it's a good observation, though. It's true.
Lewis, I mean, when he first came into Formula One, I mean, when you came into Formula One, you were already turned 30. You'd had...
All right. it wasn't my fault. I was trying...
it was an observation, not an insult. You'd been through an awful lot of hard knocks and real life experience. I mean, you lost your dad as a teenager. Your teammate was killed ahead of your first F3 season.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, you'd had a lot of, you know, pretty difficult real life experiences. You were... a pretty full... I know you're older than
I don't. I, my career does not compare Lewis Hamilton's.
But,
I understand.
But when he came in...
Yeah.
I mean, he'd... I know he'd had a tough upbringing initially, suffered bullying, racism.
Yeah.
His dad had to put up estate agents' boards for 10 quid a time, whatever, to raise money for karting initially.
Yeah.
But then once he'd been adopted by Zip and then Ron Dennis, he was kind of kept in a little cotton wool box, which gave him relatively little life experience.
Yeah. That's so possibly. We don't know. I mean, the truth is, we don't know how much life experience.
But yeah. The emotional maturity that somebody like you had coming in at an older age, he didn't seem to have when he was 22, 23, whereas now, as the age you were when you came in, sort of thing, more or less, he seems just a complete, a much more complete, I mean, you get the odd hissy fit on the radio, but they all do that. But no,
I think you start off by saying, have we seen peak Lewis? I think Lewis almost made it look easy this year, didn't he? I mean,
even though he didn't always have the best car.
Sometimes it wasn't the best car. Sometimes it was out of sorts. Maybe sometimes he dipped, but not that often. I have to say, Valtteri has not been the challenger that Nico was. Nico, by his own admission, became Mr. Nasty, you know, to try and get the upper hand on Lewis and put a lot more pressure. And Lewis looked a little bit out of sorts at times in competition against Nico. I think he found his match a little bit occasionally. Within the politics of the team, maybe. But this year, he's very much together. I think a lot of the parts have come together to the point where he's able to do it at a Stroll. He's organised his life. He's matured. He's got very creative in other aspects of his life, and he manages to balance everything else he does with being the leading contender in Formula One. So but he's, as you said earlier, he's been doing this a long time, so he's had a long time to sort it all out, but he's still only 34.
But I think also the whole season is, the picture is completely skewed, if you ask me, because if you add up all of the mistakes, and there were so many from Ferrari and Leclerc and Vettel across the year, you know, they should have come to Abu Dhabi with Charles only 9 points behind Lewis. Admittedly, Mercedes had the better car 75% of the races. Low drag circuits, Spa, Monza. Singapore was an anomaly. I think Mercedes it's a bit of an Achilles heel, Singapore, in many ways. But there were probably six races in the year where the Ferrari was unquestionably the better car. Red Bull started off on the back foot. You know, the front wing change hurt them much more than everybody else. It took till Austria when they brought an update where they really joined the party, and Max duly won. But by then, Mercedes had won the first, seven races or whatever. So I think it's a bit of a shame because the championship battle could have and should have been so much tighter and better. But, once again, Ferrari, the perennial underachievers in many ways, really.
Overachieved, if you know what I mean.
Well, in the Michael years?
Well, I think...
Oh, you mean this year?
I think this year they kind of maybe... The question you have to ask now about Ferrari is like how much of their performance was achieved during the year through using means that were later banned. If you you know what I mean?
I mean, I'll let you ask that question. But at the end of the day,
this is being recorded, by the way.
Yeah, I understand that. So we are conscious. We don't want to get a lawsuit from them. But
I know who'll be talking to Binotto when we get to Melbourne.
Do you think Binotto will still be in charge when he gets to Melbourne?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he's...
If he was in charge of a Premier League club, he'd have been gone by now, surely.
No, he'll get another year, won't he? You know, they seem to get a couple of years at least before they get booted out.
Yeah, it's a tough environment, Ferrari. Who would want that job? I mean,
it's got to be the most high-pressure job in the sport, isn't it?
Yeah.
Boss of Ferrari.
Worse than being on the Skypad.
Yeah, because you can re-record that bit. And it's only television.
Just going back briefly to Mercedes. At the beginning of the year, Bottas disappeared over the horizon in Australia. We've got a new, improved Valtteri Bottas.
Yes.
He only appeared a couple of times thereafter.
Yeah. It's not hard sure though, isn't it? I mean, he's up against the best driver in his generation. I know, I get Nico did it and managed to sneak ahead of him 1 year, but in reality, he only won that because Lewis's engine blew in Malaysia.
Yeah.
You know, he lost 20, 25 plus the 7 that Nico gained or whatever, or 3 that Nico gained that race. So it's not... I think Valtteri had 4 or 5 strong weekends where he was able to take Lewis on. it's not enough to win a world championship against Lewis. But, you know, it must be so difficult. You know, you speak to Johnny about being teammates with Michael and, OK, there were other circumstances there. People like Rubens or Massa, you know, when you're up against the best driver in your generation against in the same team, it's bloody hard, isn't it? And I think Valtteri is an excellent racing driver, but he's not Lewis. And I think that's
he's also probably exactly what Mercedes needs, because he'll plod home second or third all the time.
Yeah.
Plotting
is a little harsh.
It is a little harsh. It's a little bit harsh. No, yeah. I can see. But it's he'll get the thing to the checkered flag.
Yeah.
99 times out of 100.
That's what you
and
want.
There's no friction between teammates.
Yeah,
so,
but you know actually,
Ferrari.
If I were putting on my Toto Wolff cap, okay, there would have been races where I would have looked at Nico's performance, and I would look at where Lewis was, and I would think, blimey, if we didn't have Lewis, we'd be fifth or fourth. Mm. And that's a problem, isn't it, for them? They know that is the measure of how much more value you get from someone like Lewis, and it's worth every quid he gets, I think, for them, you know, because that would cost as much of that, not double, if they were to find that performance in development.
Exactly. I mean, the great drivers win the races that they shouldn't normally do. You know, Lewis Sochi this year, he pressurised Ferrari into all of those mistakes and the team orders mess and all the rest of it. Mercedes won the fastest car that weekend, and yet he put enough pressure on them that he won it. And Valtteri was 15 seconds behind. And that's the difference. But, I mean, he's got another chance next year, hasn't he? Because Ocon's gone off to Renault, so they've given him Valtteri another opportunity. He's got to try and dig deep over the winter and see if he can come back.
I think each year Lewis goes away, he gets away from it all. And I think I get the feeling that when he comes back to start a new season, it's almost like he's kind of half still on holiday. You know, I have seen a lot of the starts of the year. In fact, Michael was very similar. He quite often got beaten by his teammate on the first race. And I'm thinking now, actually, I got beaten by Jack Villeneuve as well. So maybe we got something in common.
And that was Jack Villeneuve.
Yeah, exactly. So I remember going to my first race for Sky. I think it was Jensen beat Lewis at in Melbourne, actually, in the first race. So, you know, it takes a while. Once Lewis finds his feet, you know, there's this point where he kind of dabbles a bit at it in the early part of the season, and then suddenly he just puts his foot down and he's off, he's gone, and there's no one can stop him. And this year he finished on a high, didn't he? I mean, you know, he was competitive right the way through. He didn't just take a holiday. He thought, I can't, and maybe the message got through, I can't afford to let Valtteri get some ahead of steam or confidence. And he just basically, we'll see how he comes out the blocks next year.
I mean, he might as well have been on holiday in Abu Dhabi. So that particular race was so easy for the Mercs.
Oh, amazing, yeah. Just really got it.
So moving on from a team that's got a balanced lineup, Ferrari.
But they have arguably the most balanced lineup. But
it's too balanced, isn't it, in some ways, because they're trying to keep them apart. Everyone expected Leclerc to be good in a Ferrari because he was brilliant in a Sauber previously, or Alfa. Did he exceed your expectations?
Not mine, no. I'd watched him in Formula 3. I remember standing watching him when in Portimao when he was doing the Formula 3 race, and then I watched him in Macau and a Po, circuits like that, which you separates the super talents from the less so. He finished on the podium in Macau as a rookie. He was brilliant at Po through the Foch chicane. I remember watching on telly thinking, he is quite special. And watched Max the previous year do this similar thing, thinking this is something special there. So, he didn't exceed my expectations in that respect. What surprised me is actually, I think Seb under-delivered, if anything. I think Charles delivered what I expected him to, in challenge Lewis and Mercedes at a handful of races across the year, managed to get a couple of wins and the rest of it. What perhaps surprised me was the fact that he outperformed Sebastian, because you would expect Sebastian, as a four-time world champion, as the number one, to be the guy there all season. And till Singapore, when they brought the update to the car in Singapore, they brought quite a big update. You know, floor, wing, barge boards. It was quite a big update. Seb was never comfortable in it. And since, from Singapore onwards, he was much more evenly matched to Leclerc. You know, he got pole in Japan and obviously won in Singapore and all the rest of it. But till Singapore, you know, Sebastian has a very particular driving style and he needs a car with a very stable rear end on corner entry, under braking, medium, slow speed. Wants to turn the car and have the rear end with him. And he couldn't do that. He couldn't drive the car the way he liked. And that, it was 2 tenths a lap. I'm not making excuses for him, but that's just the way he is. And it was only when they got the updates in Singapore that we started to see the Sebastian of old really come into play. But yeah, unfortunately, for him, as I said, I think on the whole, he looked back at the season and think, didn't really deliver what I should have done.
You know what it's like to win world titles. I mean, if you were in that kind of...
A title, singular. Singular.
Yeah. Plus brands.
I'm the champion of brands.
I've known what it's like to try to win titles, but yeah.
I mean, if you were in that kind of position now, and do you think you'd have, in that position, I know you can't put yourself in that position, but would you be tempted, do you think, to go and get your carpet slippers and go and sit down in Switzerland and have a nice quiet life?
Seb?
Yeah. Rather than have to go through all that.
Well, if you're looking at body language and so forth, he did sound very kind of down in the dumps, didn't he? He's quite young. I mean, Nico retired when he was very young, but he went out on that high, didn't he? Mm. Got his championship and off he went. I think Sebastian wants a certain condition in the team, it seems to me. And if he hasn't got that relationship with the team, he was quite comfortable with Kimi there. You know, it seemed like a good relationship. But this guy's come in and he's put him under pressure and he's not going to back off. And I think that Seb, you know how much you have to dig down to be at the sharp end of Formula One, and it's very hard. If you've got a very, very competitive teammate, you have to dig very deep. And it's the question is whether or not you can do it year in, year out at that level. You know, when you think about the intensity of the rivalry between Senna and Prost, you know, these guys were the very best in their job in the same team. That's why they fought. It's because it was so difficult to put one over on the other. And that environment is not somewhere that I think Ferrari are particularly well placed to deal with. I'm trying to think of a situation of a team. I mean, they had Prost and Mansell, which was bad enough, I think. I'm trying to think of a good relationship they had with teammates. It always seems to me very difficult for Ferrari to manage this. They prefer the...
Schumacher worked okay because then he was happy just to take the check.
Well, that's my point. Yeah, Michael still had the upper...
Oh, absolutely.
He had the conditions he wanted. And I was listening to a podcast with Rubens and, you know, it was very much Michael's team from the sounds of it. You know, he working in that environment, and I think Ferrari seemed to like, they understand that relationship. They don't know, seem to know what to do when you've got two guys fighting for the number one slot. You can't have number one slot in the team. You can't share it. It's, you know, one guy's up, one guy's down, and then their head starts spinning. So if you've got a setup that Seb needs, what do? Do we get that setup? Which direction do we go in? Do we get that one or the one that Charles Leclerc wants? Which direction are we going to go in? And, you know, Seb's fought back. He has fought back, but he drops the ball. And the thing he did in Brazil, I just thought was totally ridiculous. You know, he just didn't need to do that. The mature thing to have done would have been, you know, to finish slotting behind Charles and just let the inevitable happen because the guy was on fresh tyres. Yeah. You know, he weren't going to keep him behind, and instead he's gone into the winter with that over his head a little bit.
I mean, the team as a whole did seem to make some pretty fundamental mistakes. I'm thinking of Austria when they were focused on the speeds that Bottas was turning in, and seemed not to notice this very fast blue thing coming up. After that bit, seemed to miss that completely.
That was just being asleep, really. You know, Sochi, the whole team orders thing was just a joke. You know, on lap three, you're trying to impose team orders. And actually, it needed Seb in the cockpit to say, what are you talking about? Let us go in the first stint and break away from Mercedes, because you want to break the threat from Mercedes and sort it out. It's a one-stop race. Sort it out after the pit stops. And Seb was absolutely right. But then when he had the engine issue, and it was in the middle of them sorting out, you know, they'd done this pit stop and they just swapped over and they're trying to work it all out. And instead of thinking, the engine's blown, let's think about this, the engine's gone, make him stop somewhere that's not going to induce a safety car. They make him stop at a part of the track where there's literally no gate, and you have to get a safety car, and it costs him the win. It's just, you know, some of it's basic. Monaco, they didn't send Leclerc out for a second run. I mean, it doesn't matter how many tyres you don't have in Q2. In a Ferrari, you're going to get to Q3 anyway. What are you talking about? You know, if you're out in Q1 at Monaco, you're finished. And it's just some fundamental things that you just looked at it and went, what are you doing?
Let's move on to a team that does operate like a racing team. Turns in 1.8, 1.9 second tyre stop somehow. Red Bull. I mean, obviously, Max is volatile. Very, very fast. Mm. Do you see that that's Red Bull, Honda? I mean, obviously, Red Bull and Honda just had a very open and complementary relationship last year and made pretty solid progress. I mean, Honda didn't exactly look like winning a race with McLaren. But, you know, that in the first season with the proper, another top team shows what they could do. Do you see them being the main threat to Mercedes next season?
Me?
Either of you.
Yeah. I do. I think they're going to be a threat. I think they're going to be very
You close. Both have a glass of red wine. You're both falling asleep.
No, I think it's... it takes half a glass of red wine. I genuinely think they are going to be much closer to Mercedes as a challenger, because I think what we've got is the red... I know that they're big teams and they can probably work on two fronts, but even so, it's going to detract. At some point in the season, there's going to be a tailing off of investment in these current cars, the 2020 cars, for the 2021 cars. So there's going to be a development drop-off somewhere during the season. And I think that the trend with Red Bull is up. They've been getting better. The car looks better. It's been closer in more races than it's not. And Honda want to keep pushing. They've signed up. They know they're carrying on. So there's no reason for them to back off on that front. And I think that Mercedes are, on the engine front, and the power unit front, I think Mercedes are starting to level out. They're reaching a ceiling somewhere and they don't seem to be able to break through. So that gap could close. And I do think that they could be and maybe not, certainly taking wins off of Mercedes, I think, or being in the mix more.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure about when you said your comment on Max. I think we saw a different Max this year, to be honest. We saw a mistake in Mexico where he didn't back off and Bottas a crash and obviously got the penalty and lost potential win there. But he's been exceptional this year.
Oh, absolutely. Volatile, that sort of meant, you know, his character.
In the cockpit, he's a remarkable, remarkable young guy. You know, he's, for how young he is, I often have the team radio channel set up and listen through, and I've got Lewis, Max, Leclerc and Vettel. And the tone... between the difference between them, you wouldn't imagine that Max is the calmest out of the lot. He's just, he knows what he wants. He knows what he wants from the car. He knows what information he wants from the engineer. He doesn't mess around and use five sentences when he can use one or five words and he can use one. And he just has a very methodical way. His mind is so mature beyond his actual age. It's remarkable. And I hope they hit the ground running, because that's been the problem in recent years, is they haven't arrived in Melbourne with a car that's there. It's taken half a season for them to get on top of it. If they rock up in Melbourne with a car competitive enough, he will be a championship contender, because he's mentally ready for it.
So, hypothetical situation. You two go to the pub later, decide you're going to set up a Formula One team next year, Hill Chandog Racing or vice versa. Lead driver, Charles Leclerc or Max Verstappen?
Oh. Max. Oh. Max.
Yeah, that's. I'd probably go with what Karen just said there, because as he just described, the guy's so mature. I mean, it's incredible to believe. He's only what, 21? 21 now?
22. Oh, yeah. He's not very old.
I mean, it's a baby. But he's not a baby. That's the point. He's actually You only have to talk to him and see him go about his business. He's logical. He's matter of fact. He doesn't get involved in a lot of politics too much, does he? He just is a very, very impressive individual. And he was like that from the moment he arrived. Even when he was 17, it was just seemed incredible that this guy was so mature. So the speed he's got, the maturity he's got, the aggressiveness. He's one or two dropouts, but really for his age, I think he's a little bit ahead of Charles. Charles has made one or two errors. He admits to his own mistakes, which is perhaps a little bit too hasty sometimes. But that's a good sign. At least he's not trying to hide from things. And I think he's got a good character too, Charles. But still got a lot to learn on the. I think about Formula One and the racing side of things and the tactic. Yeah.
He's more emotional, I think, as a character. You listen to him on the radio and you see his body language and stuff. There's lots of ups and downs. As Max is a bit flatter in that respect. And we saw mistakes in Baku from Charles. We saw a mistake in Monaco, Melbourne in the race. He was off a few times. There've been instances in the races where there's certain stints where you see moments, the odd lockup and the odd runoff into the runoff area and stuff. Whereas you see Max in that sort of Schumacher-esque way and Alonso-esque way, just rattling out lap after lap. I think that's.
Do you think that when you hear Max on the radio and you hear far more of it than I do? Mm. He's very, as you say, he knows what he wants. He's very authoritative. Whereas Charles sometimes, in conversation on the radio, seems a little bit, there's a little bit. Doesn't have the same air of authority, decisiveness yet.
I think that's
what I'm saying. It's emotional maturity in some way, and I think that's where Max is actually the most impressive part. The driving bit, they're all exceptional. They're all fantastic talents. But I think the difference between them is, as we've talked about already, is just Max's emotional maturity just takes him to a different level.
Looking at the slightly bigger Red Bull picture, they've got, next year they've got Max Verstappen alongside a driver they sacked, then rehired, then promoted to replace a driver who'd been promoted but then got sacked, no, relegated. And the other guy in the Toro Rosso has been sacked twice and then reinstated.
Yes.
There was a time when they had a talent pool just south of Formula One, which they'd have 6-7 drivers who were potentially just about ready to plug into a Toro Rosso.
When I was a Red Bull Junior in GP2, it was Buemi, myself, and Michael Amamuller in GP2, but they also had Jev, Daniel Ricciardo, Jaime Alguersuari in Formula 3. They had Robert Wickens and Michael Aleshin in F2. They had 7-8 of us all there, just sort of on the periphery, really. And I think some of the effect came when they had a point where they thought, hang on, why are we investing all this money in all these junior categories? Because it was millions, GP2 budget, Formula 3 budget and stuff. And when they had, they had Seb, Daniel, Carlos Sainz Jr., and they had Kvyat at the time, and they were all doing a reasonable job, and they had quite a young, and then they had Max. So they had this sort of talent pool already in F1 of young drivers. And it's almost like they didn't think that Seb would leave and go to Ferrari. They didn't think Daniel would leave and go to Renault. And all of a sudden, there are these big holes. And the one that I can't understand is why they didn't take Carlos back. Because I believe there was a window of opportunity where, he was at Renault for a year, and before he went to McLaren, there was a small window where he could have gone back to the main Red Bull team, not to Toro Rosso, but they would have had to guarantee him a seat at the top team. And they didn't take it, and they signed Gasly. And to me, that decision there is, if you look at what Carlos has done this year, to me, he's my third, he's the third best driver if I did a ranking this season. I'd have Carlos at number three. I think he's done an exceptional job this season.
Yeah, one of the big problems we've got is people's careers now in Formula 1 are going for 20 years.
No, well, it's a good thing in some ways because it's a measure of safety.
It's a measure of safety. I mean, I do remember Bernie coming out with one of his classics a few years ago, and because people were talking about why people were in Formula One for so long, and he said that the problem is that they're not getting killed enough. Yeah. You know? And in his own inimitable way, there's such a lot of heart and feeling in there. He's very much misunderstood person. We understand what he was saying. It's just the way he said it was a bit brutal. But that is a fact.
89-year-old man.
But this was when he was a bit younger as well. Yeah. So, but
79.
He was only 70, yeah. Yeah. But the point is that, you know, people, there was a throughput, shall we put it, in motor racing not so long ago. And even a long career would be 15 seasons. And now you've got Kimi there who's, what is he? He must be there for his 19th season.
2002 was his first. No, 2001, wasn't it? 2001,
2001. Yeah. So we're up to 19.
I mean, he disappeared off rallying for a little while.
Yeah, he disappeared for a bit, came back.
But Lewis is the second oldest driver.
Yeah. And so the careers are going on for a long time. How do you get throughput? And I think Red Bull, to be honest, we have to thank Red Bull for bringing up lots of talent. And of course, finding Max Verstappen as well.
And Vettel.
And Seb and all those. Yeah, and some great drivers. Danny Rick, exactly. So Carlos. And so Red Bull are one of the few teams, going back to a little bit what we were saying, comparing a racing team to Ferrari. I think Red Bull are a racing team. I often describe Williams as an engineering team that went racing. And I think Ferrari a little bit like that. But Red Bull are a race team, and they've done this thing. They've gone out and they've found the very best talent. They've got a guy to do that. They've got Helmut Marko, and he's gone out and he's found the most talented guys, and he's given them the most incredible opportunity of a lifetime by saying, we can take you all the way to F1. All you have to do is win everything.
Yeah.
All right? That's simple, right? So no pressure, but if you don't win, forget it, you're off. And actually, you know, what racing driver worth their salt wouldn't grab that with both hands and give it everything they've got? And it's produced these very, very talented drivers, but they can't put them all in the same team.
But I think
to your original point,
has Marko dropped the ball with that, and have Red Bull dropped the ball in terms of that feeding the system, I guess, is sort of where you're going with the drivers they've ended up with. And you could argue that, yes, they did, because they didn't sign Leclerc when he was coming along. They didn't sign Lando when he was coming along, or George Russell, or Ocon. You know, other teams and other people got there first.
They've got enough. They can't.
But they don't, though. And I think that's...
They've got loads of kids at karting level and Formula Renault level, but there's nothing plugging the gap in between.
They this year had two drivers alongside Max, neither of whose average was less than 4/10 away from him. Mm. That's, I mean, a 4/10 delta to your teammate is massive, really.
And
I think, therefore, that leaves that gap. You know, if they had an Ocon or a Leclerc or a Lando or a George, would that gap have been closer?
Are they in any different situation to Mercedes, though? I mean, they're putting a lot of emphasis or putting a lot of eggs in one basket in terms of drivers, aren't they? So Lewis is key to Mercedes, and also Max is key to
It is a bit different. I think it's a little bit different because Valtteri still finished second in the World Championship. His average qualifying gap to Lewis was only I think Ant and I looked at it, was 0.12 or something like that. You know, it's less than a tenth and a half.
Breathing space,
so they got somebody there who's, when Lewis falters, Valtteri had certain days, as you mentioned before, where he was fourth, fifth and sixth. But for the most part, across the year, if Lewis decided halfway through the year that he was off to be a rap artist, he would have still probably won the World Championship with Valtteri. And I think Red Bull haven't got that. Mm. And that's the difference. And I think Alex deserves another chance. He missed half the season, didn't do any of the testing. He deserves another opportunity to close that gap. You know, they replaced Gasly for him. Gasly, in some ways, the perception is, it's funny, isn't it, the perception in this game, because when you look at the average qualifying gap between Gasly and Max, and then Albon and Max, Albon's actually further away, only by 200s, but he's further away. Yet,
Because race performances have been better.
Because in the races, he's been able to come through. But also, I think some of it is because Gasly went through the first seven races where the Red Bull wasn't as good. Mm. You know, and therefore, he would qualify sometimes surrounded by the midfield. Because the car wasn't as good as it was later in the year, he couldn't get through the midfield pack. So by the time he eventually sometimes got through, the leaders are gone. They're 45 seconds up the road, and then they start. He gets lapped. I mean, the race in Hungary was probably his lowest point. You know, he was over a minute behind Max, who nearly won the race. And I think they were right to promote Albon at that point. But what Gasly then did in the Toro Rosso shows that he's not a bad racing driver. You know, he did a very good job in the Toro Rosso. So it's a perception game as much as anything else, isn't it?
From what I've heard is that I think the Red Bull is actually a trickier car to drive, though,
it is, yeah,
than the Toro Rosso. So there's a little bit of an art to finding the sweet spot with that car.
It's a bit like the Ducatis in MotoGP, wasn't it? All those years where Casey Stoner was the only one who seemed to be able to win anything and everything on it.
He
and then
probably,
nobody
he'd
had to
probably
close.
Managed.
I'd be able to do
yeah.
it. I'd be able to do it.
Yeah,
that's right. I just never, I'm afraid I've moved on to better things by then. No, I love bike racing. I mean, it is incredible when you look at what, I know we're here to talk about cars, but Marc Marquez in what he's doing on motorbikes is just mind-blowing. And I think it does raise a question for our sport. You know, we've got these regulation changes coming in, and they've done a lot of work on trying to get the racing closer. We'll see. I'm optimistic for that. But what I think that we're missing is the what you can see of the driving art from the outside a little bit. You know, we obviously see it in the wet. In qualifying, you get the fantastic close-ups, and you can see where the drivers are actually doing stuff. But you only have to look at a couple of laps of MotoGP, and you see them doing the most extraordinary things on these bikes.
The other thing is, I mean, a MotoGP bike around Silverstone is about 28, 30 seconds slower than the Formula One car, yeah. Which looks more spectacular.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the racing, as Damon mentioned, you know, the fact that although Marquez utterly dominated the season and, you know, won it with time to spare, but they're able to go wheel to wheel and the elbows out and, you know, he's.
Shoulders out.
Yeah. You're never going to get that in car racing. We should also manage our expectations. But what we have now is ridiculous. You know, I think
you didn't watch Damon in the Formula Ford Festival.
No, I didn't.
I was born.
What year was that?
Oh, I can't remember.
When were you born? 84, 85.
I was born in 84.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, yeah.
But
you
no, I didn't.
It was. Yeah, I had nothing to do with that. You know, when you look at talking about the visual, how it appears, when you look at Goodwood, I think a lot of people here will understand this. You know, when you look at the cars going around Goodwood, like these Jaguars or whatever, they're sliding around, and it looks fantastic to see someone controlling a car. The lap time is dreadful, you know, but the racing is fantastically close. And I think that we went down this road with aero. We're stuck with it. If you look at cars, F1 cars now, you turn on the TV and you see the camera angles are very good now. The speed looks amazing. If you go to Silverstone, you look at them going through the Beckett section, it is phenomenal to see how fast they go. But after a while, you get used to it. After a while, you're going to go, that's how fast they go. And they go around Melbourne, 10 seconds of that pole position was 10 seconds. That's one of the tracks that hasn't changed on the calendar. And they go around there 10 seconds a lap faster than my pole position. Oh, we're in 96. So
Villeneuve was on pole in 96, wasn't he?
All right. Fair point.
Just a point, yeah.
That's a fair point. Anyway, the pole position of 96.
You won the race.
But I won the race. Did, anyway, yeah. But it doesn't matter. We're not here to talk about me.
I was talking about
Well,
Jeff
there's
Villeneuve.
Another thing. There's another thing. But yeah, so my point is, Formula One cars, people seemed satisfied with Formula One cars then. They seemed fast, and people turned up to watch it. And now they're 10 seconds a lap faster. But do we get any more of that? Do we understand what that means?
You're absolutely right. I think what happened in 2017, the rule change that happened in 2017, was wrong. And, you know, at the time, I believed it was wrong. And, you know, sort of 3 years into these rule changes, I stand by it. Because someone somewhere got hung up on lap time. Someone got hung up about, you know, in 2016, oh, the cars don't look fast enough. Let's make them faster. Guess what? It makes the racing worse. And we all, you know, there's so many people who looked at it at the time and went, this is just wrong. And in some ways, there were too many engineering and engineers leading that decision-making process. And engineers love making fast, you know, I know we're in a building with engineering royalty, but
these electrical engineers.
They're electrical.
They're electrical engineers.
As we learned earlier.
We've learned this, yeah. So, mechanical engineers are down the road.
Down
so
the
we
road.
Need to, you know,
but it's the aero.
It's a start fight.
It's the aero guys that actually made a mess of this one. But, yeah, and I think, you know, that's what we needed was entertainment people saying, hang on, actually what we want is racing to be more entertaining.
Well, we've got Liberty, who are entertainment,
which is now
people.
Coming
they
along.
They're entertainment people,
yeah,
aren't they?
But yeah. They weren't there when that rule change happened. So hopefully 21, as you talked about before.
Yeah.
Everything that we heard in Austin makes us cautiously optimistic that it's going to be better.
Yeah. Princess Yachts, the UK's leading luxury yacht manufacturer. Proud sponsors of Motorsports Formula One coverage.
When we sat down as a group and looked at the brief originally, foiling kind of jumped out as an option. Traditionally, hydrofoils on powerboats have just been static and they've helped to increase the efficiency slightly. These not only do that, they're active, so they help control the roll and pitch of the boat and make the boat not only more comfortable, but safer and easier to drive. We are on the cusp here, I think, of changing the direction of the boat industry. AFS works in conjunction with a reimagined hull concept. Low transfer immersion brings higher efficiencies at cruising speeds. Foil lift replaces transom volume, allowing top speeds to still be achieved. Foils automatically deploy and retract flush with the hull. The foils rake fore and aft, varying the angle of attack. Port and starboard foils are controlled independently. Onboard sensors and a dedicated processor calculate the optimum foil position 100 times per second. Foil position is actively controlled, reacting to the boat state, improving comfort, stability and safety with modes selected by the skipper.
One of the feel-good stories of the season was McLaren's recovery from sort of more or less the back of the grid up to fighting in the top six on a reasonably regular basis. It was a McLaren, still a Renault engine. But they had two new drivers, Sainz and Norris. What was the sweet spot? What was the ingredient there that made do you think that, you know, made the recovery possible?
Aero. You know, ultimately, as you said, the power unit rules are they're homologated. They haven't changed vastly. They went down this sort of rabbit hole in 2018. I mean, there were times where Alonso was being out-qualified by Sergei Sirokin and Lance Stroll in the Williams, and no disrespect to them, but they're not Fernando Alonso, and that convincingly showed that McLaren at times had the slowest car in 2018. So their turnaround has been remarkable. It's unbelievable, and it shows that turnarounds are possible still in the sport. But it's all about aero, and, you know, James Key, Andreas Seidel joined the team, and they sort of walked into this thing where the car's better. Their effect will only be seen next year. But they're on the up, aren't they? They've got a Mercedes engine contract in the bag. They've got a new wind tunnel coming. They've got two brilliant, young, talented drivers. As I said, James Key and Andreas Seidel at the top. Zach now doing what he does best. He doesn't have to manage his team day-to-day because he's got Andreas doing that.
So he can go out and sell the sponsorship.
There's the sponsor deals coming in. McLaren, on the whole, is massively on the up.
But that didn't happen by accident. I mean, Zach went in there. Zach is a very pragmatic person. He doesn't want a long, complicated answer. Yep. He won't give you a long, complicated answer. You know, if he says, and he probably
won't. Despite being American.
that's his way. And I think, and he went into McLaren, and I think he got a lot of answers he wasn't satisfied with. And he went, this isn't right. And he's made some changes. So we've got to give him a lot of credit for what has happened at McLaren. He's had the balls to do it. It's not easy when you go into a team with a reputation like that, but he wasn't cowed by that. He wasn't intimidated by that, and he knew what had to be done, and he's got Adrian Suttle and James Key and Andreas Seidel, and James Key in there, and he's made changes, and some people who were there are no longer there. Sometimes it has to happen. Sometimes a shake-up has to happen, and I think we're seeing the fruits of his bravery, you know, to actually make changes coming to fruition there.
We just had the 5-minute board for this section of the evening. So
right, okay.
A couple more questions before we turn the microphone to the audience. And we've already established that the new Hill Chandock Formula One team in 2021.
We've nicked Max.
Yeah, you've got Max. Max is Max.
You've got
Max.
So, are you paying his wages?
No.
Choices for the second driver: Lando Norris, George Russell, Alexander Albon.
Does it have to be one of those three?
You're not getting it. The Well, I just of the three rookies this year.
Rookies,
I mean,
okay.
Yeah, if you had to choose a rookie,
I'm going to jump on Lando, right? And I think that I would, no disrespect to George, because the thing is, we just can't measure what he's done in a way. Yep. But Lando, I think...
The George Russell drove rings around Lando in Formula 2, that George Russell.
Well, we unfortunately, this is about F1. Can they do it? And when you've got all the pressure and stuff, I think Lando did an absolutely fantastic job for a newcomer to Formula 1.
Teenage newcomer.
Yeah, absolutely amazing. And sensible, you know, it doesn't show signs of it going to his head. You know, he is himself. He's relaxed with interviews. He's, you know, mixes with the guys. I think it's amazing, yeah.
I would agree, actually. And they've been teammates already, haven't they? Max and Lando, they play this esports championship.
Oh, yeah.
Teammates already.
So when they're not doing Grand Prix, real Grand Prix, they seem to be.
I did this thing with them on the Skypad in Brazil, and they both showed up. And we stood there. We ended up standing there chatting for about half an hour. It was after free practice, I think, on the Friday. And we stood there chatting away. And they were going on and on about this esports race that they've got coming up. They absolutely love it. They get away from race weekend and they're playing, you know, on this thing. They're doing 24-hour races at Spa and all sorts of things. They are absolutely addicted.
We'd have to stop that, though, wouldn't we? We can't have them playing computer games in their room all the time, can we?
You can see you're much more experienced dad than me.
We want them down for supper. I mean, what?
Did you and Martin Donnelly not do this in Formula 3?
Sorry, what?
No, so did you and Martin Donnelly not do this in Formula 3?
Oh, we didn't have computer games in those days. What did we play? Oh, God, I don't think they had... We had that thing that you played table tennis on, you know, that's about, you know, ping pong, whatever it's called.
What, table?
Okay, last one for me. You mentioned earlier that Carlos Sainz would be your third driver. So, 1, 2, 3 from both of you.
Lewis, Max, Carlos.
Is this a prediction for the season or what?
No. This is your top three of the season. You've just been watching.
I would say Lewis. I would say Max and then Charles. Yeah.
Okay. Right, ladies and gents, there should be a microphone somewhere.
In that corner.
Microphone.
There it is.
Okay. Is there any chance we could just have a little bit more light so I can actually see where the hands are up? Is that? It always helps.
There you are.
Thank you. Oh, hello.
Gosh. Right. I thought we were alone.
Raise your hands if you have a question for either anybody. Start down there.
Hi there. I'm a fan of all motorsport, but out of the two, Marc Marquez or Lewis Hamilton, which one's the more dominant in their sport?
Marquez, I think. I mean, he's 26 years old and he's won 9 world championships. The guy is, it makes everyone just feel like you're a massive underachiever in life, don't you? It's depressing.
Okay, gentleman in a Hawaiian shirt, just there.
Hi, do you think Max Verstappen sort of shot himself in the foot a bit, being critical of Ferrari and with the potential drive for the future with Ferrari? With the accusation of cheating?
I think, in my experience in our sport, that people have... When somebody as talented as Max is available and Ferrari wants him, they'll forget all of that. And, it will be suddenly all sweetness and light. Yeah.
OK, let's go over on the left here.
We know we can't compare eras, but... We can't compare eras, but Schumacher and Hamilton are probably close enough together to compare. Yeah. Who's the best?
Okay. Karen, you go.
No.
Okay.
you raced against him. Go on.
Obviously, I think...
You crashed into Michael. You should know. You know about him.
I did crash into him. He crashed into me.
True. Yes, he did.
So, yeah. I think when you look at Lewis's crashing record, it's quite low, isn't it? I mean, so on that basis, you'd have to say that Lewis is a better driver.
never crashing.
Okay, gentleman just there in a light-coloured jacket, kind of behind you.
I think that it hasn't been mentioned in any way, shape or form this discussion at the moment, but surely Vettel has massively underperformed this year. And everybody's puzzled why he hasn't been dropped yet. Because, and then, of course, the idea is, who would replace him? And would it be Verstappen's interest to join Ferrari?
I think the slight problem Ferrari still have got is Leclerc's not yet experienced enough to be the team's number one. And I think in some respect, they do still need Seb there from a technical perspective to lead that team's direction. And if you look at the way the car got better through the year, a lot of that came because of Sebastian. You know, Charles benefited from it. But we saw a lot of mistakes still from Charles. We saw in qualifying, you know, errors on the first run, which meant he had to have another go and use another set. You know, all those sort of things, which will come good. You know, he's got talent, and you'd like to think that he'll iron that up with maturity and experience. I don't think they could afford to still get rid of Seb and put the you know, Charles in as the number one, unless Max or Lewis came available. I think, you know, it's all well and good to say, oh, Seb's made all of these mistakes in the races, which he has, of course, and as you say, he's underperformed. But who do you replace him with? And when you look at the market, you can say possibly Sainz, as, you know, if you got Lewis, Max, you could argue a case for Sainz, but then he'd be a new person, and Sainz and Leclerc is quite an inexperienced lineup to lead a high-pressure team like Ferrari. You know, I think next year when Sebastian's contract runs up and Lewis, you know, is sniffing around elsewhere, Ferrari's certainly interested in him for 21. I think end of next year is going to be fun because you've got 21 new car regs, new technical regs, whole reset in F1. But the driver market is completely up in the air as well. So I think there's a... Next year is a little bit of a transitional year in some way.
I think your point is that Seb has had, for someone who's won four world championships, he's had some pretty serious dropouts. He's obviously very capable and still a bit... But I think the encouraging quote I saw from him after Abu Dhabi was that he knows he has to go and improve. And I think that's the first time I've heard him say something like that. I think normally he's tended to bat away any criticism and regard himself as always in the right when he's done some very odd things, where clearly he had some part to account for it. But I think that's what has to happen with Seb. He has to sit down. He has to go, okay, listen, something's not right. If I've been leading a race and I've dropped the ball, that should not happen. If I am a four-time world champion, can I accept that this is part of my package? And why do I suddenly lose my temper in a car? Because that's what happened. He cracked in Canada. You know, it's not the first time that's happened. And he has to look at why he has those mental weak spots, because they are real and they're damaging to his career and his potential. So if you can fix that, then he could have a long and very prosperous career from here onwards. He's still quite young.
So neither of you would put Kimi back in, would they? We'll start down here and then next, okay?
Okay, we mentioned McLaren coming good. What do you think about Honda's compared with a few years ago? And then a follow-up to that, what do you think may have happened to Honda and McLaren able to keep their relationship going this year?
They got really good electrical engineers. Yeah. So we had a chat before.
Thank you. Yeah. So the question is, as I understand it, is that Honda? What do we think of Honda's potential? I think they have. I think they didn't like the environment, and in Japan, it's not the done thing to be openly critical and humiliating companies with a reputation like Honda. So that put them under a very difficult pressure when they were with McLaren. I think it was a battle of two reputations in a way. McLaren didn't want to be saddled with the accusation that their car wasn't up to it, and Honda didn't feel comfortable with this pressure. And unbelievably, actually, in some ways, Red Bull have allowed them the space and not put the pressure on them and said, okay, listen, you do what you do and we will work around that.
And it's and that combination has worked and delivered the results. And I think if you just let Honda get on with it, they will produce. They're a fantastic company. They're a racing company. They started out with racing, and they believe in themselves and they believe in their method, and they'll get there.
They have committed 500 million to the program or something. So
yeah, the 500 like million. Yeah, but they don't have 500 million if they were a rubbish company.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So that's yeah.
Now I think they have made the progress. I'm not sure they're fully there yet. Yes, Red Bull didn't have any Honda-related reliability issues on the Sundays in the races, but we've got to keep in mind that it's really it's a four-car team split into the A and the B team, and the Torosos went through 7 power units each and took a lot of penalties. So there's an element of them doing a bit of experimenting and R&D for the big team. So you have to factor that into the picture. But you're absolutely right. They made really good progress and, you know, long may it continue.
Just want to say, when in the turbo era, I can remember you could tell when Honda were bringing a big push in because their engines would blow up. It was fantastic. They'd be, you know, they'd just put another engine in and they'd go out and this great big ball of fire would come out the back of the car. And you just knew they were pushing. You know, they were pushing everything. It was good.
So thanks, Connor.
Can you give me some idea of what happened with Paddy Lowe at Williams this year? I mean, the fact they're 3.5 seconds adrift or whatever it is, and all of a sudden Paddy Lowe was fired 2 days before the start of the season, apparently not knowing which way was up.
Now, inside man at Williams, Caroon, is going to answer that question. Yeah.
I don't know, really. Yes, I mean, are you asking where he is now? Or where? It's fundamentally an aero issue, really. You know, Paddy's not an aerodynamicist. And I think ultimately the team on the whole have lost their way. You know, we are very much in an aero era of Formula One. And the 2017 car was not bad. You know, I drove it and, you know, and I remember driving at the time thinking, actually, you know, it's a balanced car. And it was a car that could get into Q3. You know, Massa could rack up points. Stroll got a podium in Baku. You know, it was a decent car. And then whatever happened in the design of the 18 and then subsequently the 19 car, they've just lost their way, technically. And I think they've lost a lot of people, good people there in the last 2 years, really. You've lost Dirk De Beer, Paddy Lowe, as you mentioned, Rob Smedley's gone. And they haven't really replaced them. And I think for the long-term success of that team, they kind of need to do what McLaren have done in many ways and just go, right, hang on, whatever we were doing is not working. We need a change of mentality, a reset, change of design philosophy, change of concept. And then they can make progress because they've still got the Mercedes power unit. You know, that's a massive plus point. So clearly that's not the issue in the competitiveness. It's an aero issue and they need to get that sorted. Whether that's, it's not one person though. It's a complete department needs a reset and a change in the thought process and philosophy.
Lord,
young friends. Motorsport, I think, where there was Claire Williams being interviewed with another guy, Mike, somebody there?
Michael Driscoll, CEO.
And they were talking about what was going on, and they said, well, that was all down to these people, and nobody seemed to know who was actually leading the design or anything else like that. It was, oh, it has to work, whose problem's that? Mm. But it was actually.
Yeah. I think that,
I'll let you
Karen,
that.
Karen just alluded to it. I think that they're a little bit lost, and I think that Claire needs to find someone that can organise the technical team but getting someone to go to Williams because it's an enormous job, and have they got the money? That's now another problem. Yeah.
Okay, gentlemen down here on the right.
Yeah, not a technical question. What's Kimi really like?
I've met Kimi very briefly for dinner. He didn't say much. he goes in and out the paddock. He hardly says anything to anyone, does he?
I've had one conversation with him in 20 years.
Was it a conversation though?
Well, he came up. It was bizarre, really, because we were in a bar in Tokyo after the race, and he was at some ridiculous time in the morning, and he'd obviously had a lot of clear liquid.
Orange juice.
Orange juice. But he just came up to me and went, "I want a curry, take me somewhere." And I just stood there and went, "I haven't spoken to you in a decade, sure, we could go to dinner, that'll be fun." And then when I said I didn't know where a curry restaurant was in Tokyo, he got me in a headlock, wrestled me to the ground, and then just walked off. So, I've had one conversation with the man.
He's priceless, isn't he?
I had to do a piece with Renault when he was there, and I was begging them to let me interview Grosjean. And they said, no, you've got to talk to Kimi. I said, I want Grosjean. But there was just two of us talking to him, and he chatted for half an hour, and I'd never known him like that, and he was just completely...
But he did this podcast with Tom Clarkson on the F1 podcast. And he's actually quite chatty, remarkably.
Yeah, apparently
his book is quite
boring.
Quite good. Is it?
Yeah,
I don't know, I haven't read it. Somebody else said to me there's some good stories in there.
That's not the one with the haiku poems in, is it?
No, that is funny.
I actually just remembered I did interview him for Sky about, that must have been about 5 or 6 years ago now, but he's a lovely guy. He seems a nice guy, doesn't he?
I had one conversation with him.
Yeah.
He put me in a headlock.
Yeah, that's it. It's nice, like I said, he's a nice guy.
Let's go to the back. There's a hand just up there near you, Connor.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market. Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Thanks for that, Simon. Read in the papers today that Mr. Stroll Sr. wants to take a stake in Aston Martin. Lance Stroll for Red Bull in 21?
I read the story on Reuters, actually. Was it not that they would be sponsoring Racing Point? Is at least the story that I read in that bit that... I think the story I read was and again, it's all obviously speculative at the time, but it sounds like he was looking to buy the road car company and have them support his Formula One team. So if anything, it involved Aston Martin switching from Red Bull to Racing Point. That's the way I only read the story on the sort of Reuters website.
The autocar story said that he was looking to buy a stake in the road car company.
Yes.
The share price for the first time ever then went up.
Yeah.
And then he should have
kept his mouth shut.
And then,
I've got shares.
And then rebrand Racing Point as Aston Martin, which then what happens with Red... who knows?
But yeah, Aston Martin is... Aston Martin is a sports car brand, isn't it?
They did do a Formula One car in 1959.
I knew you'd know that. I mean, yeah. Did they really?
Yeah.
How'd
DBR,
it go?
DBR4.
Was it good? DBR, okay. Was it good? No.
Because it was front engine at the time, all the engines were going in the back, so it was long.
But it must be great to wake up one morning and go, I think I'll go and buy Aston Martin. A bit bored, go and get Aston. We just think about buying a car, and he goes and buys the company. Yeah.
And in my case, spending about $2,000 on a car, that's it. Okay, there's a cream coloured shirt just near you, Laura, there.
Nico Hülkenberg, is that a career well spent, or could he have spent that better at a potentially bigger team?
I think. I mean, we saw some flashes of his ability, and I've always thought he was just such a laid back guy. There wasn't enough fire there. There wasn't enough anxiety, and
he seemed to miss the boat every time there was low hanging fruit. You know, you always thought when there was an opportunity of a, you know, of this sort of odd podium where a non top three team could get it, it would be Perez or Sainz, or, you know, got in Brazil, or there'd always be somebody, Stroll in Baku, or there'd be somebody else but Nico Hülkenberg, because on that day, you know, in Brazil 2012, he crashed into Lewis. In Baku, when Perez got the podium, he hit the inside wall or something. You know, there was always that race where there was something weird would happen, but he'd be the one in that mess rather than the one getting the podium.
He was unfortunate because at the time when all the drivers were forced to lose a lot of weight, his hulk, literally, his bulk, was a technical massive disadvantage. So yeah. I know for a fact he didn't get drives, that some top teams looked at him and just thought, we can't put him in because it's going to be too much of a deficit, just simply because of his size, which is a real shame. But they since then increased the allowance for the driver. But I do think that, you know, maybe he's just too nice a guy, and I think you need to have a nasty streak. Just look at me, for example.
I was about to be nice to you, but I think
I think he should have ended up at Haas, though. I think it would have been good for Haas because he's experienced. He is still very quick
to replace
Grosjean.
But then Grosjean's wife's not around, and yeah, that'll upset Damon.
I'm not saying anything.
We're not going there again.
Okay. You started last time.
I did. Yeah. But she's very nice.
The thing that mystifies me about Hülkenberg, though, is that, and I accept the weight thing completely, but he was a champion in Formula BMW when his weight kind of helped. He was a champion in A1GP, weight no difference. Champion in Formula 3, a rookie champion in GP2. I mean, everything about his career.
Yeah, it's
special talent.
I think he probably could have done with a better manager.
Yes.
Actually, to be honest, I think he needed someone to say, you know, this guy's, look at his, like you, could have been his manager. If you've gone
in,
it's a bit late. It's all too late. It's a shame, isn't it? Mm. But he needed someone, there were certain times, Frentzen was like that.
Yes, yeah.
Frentzen was unbelievably quick. I mean, he went up and down a little bit, but he was just,
he had a good manager, he nicked your drive.
I said to him once, I said, why are you going for, I remember talking to him, and he was like, there was a McLaren drive up for offer, and he was winning everything in the Jordan. And I said, are you going to go for this drive? And he said, oh, do you think I should? And I went, are you bloody mad? You know, some drivers just don't, they haven't worked out that you need a strategy to get through Formula 1 and stay in Formula 1.
Okay, it's gentleman down here. Thanks.
Just wondering what you thought about the reintroduction of refueling, maybe.
Maybe what do you think about the introduction of refueling? Should we do a... Well, we won't bother with the hands up then. Right, okay. Why not? Because if you talk to a lot of people, they think it'd be really exciting.
Why would you do it?
I know why we wouldn't do it, but I mean, a lot of people seem to like the drama of the pit stop or something.
Well,
you know,
Well, there were three big fires in 15 years, sort of.
No,
I don't get it.
The fastest lap stat against. So you got Lewis and Michael, and Michael's got all these fastest laps. And as I explained to someone, that's because in those days we had refueling and everything was run flat out. So, you know, you got a lot of flat out.
Yeah, but the racing was dull.
Well, I agree. Oh, you don't have to tell me. I know. I was there.
Just checking.
We had to go flat out all the time. And we went exactly the same speed as we did in qualifying. The car was like, and you didn't catch them up because they were going flat out.
There's top left-hand corner there. Connor, thanks.
Hello. My question is, with you both having experienced cars from various eras, how much of a leap do you expect the 2021 cars to be, not necessarily with regards to lap time?
Well, I think the lap time difference they're talking about is negligible. If frankly. You know, what they're talking about today is 3 seconds, which they'll catch up. In a year of development in the wind tunnel, the teams will catch that, no problem. Even if it's slightly behind, I don't think it really matters. What we want is them to be able to race wheel to wheel. And drivers will adapt. You know, eras change, technology comes and goes, traction control and active suspension and all this came and went. And, you know, the best drivers are still winning and the best teams are still there or thereabouts. You'll have some sort of a shake-up. You know, when active got banned, Benetton suddenly in 94 came to the front. You know, but Williams was still there or thereabouts, and McLaren and Ferrari were still the next two down. So I think ultimately, eras change, technology, that's always the nature of F1. I think 21 is really important for the future of F1, because if you look at what's happening in the road car world, you know, the sport is at a crossroads. You know, they've got to get this next set of regulations right, otherwise F1... In the long term, you know, it is really important because
with the environmental, the rise of concern over the global warming and the environment. I mean, Formula One has already put in place measures or announced it's going to go carbon neutral. But I mean, people will be looking at the sport and going, why are we doing this? You know, are we promoting profligacy with fuels? They're looking to use more renewable fuels as well. So that could be a technical avenue that we could go down. But of course, the Formula E will contest their credentials against Formula One. So there's going to be a bit of debate that. So
despite the fact that they use generators to charge the cars,
yeah,
to go around the world.
But you know, in people's minds, we've got to work out whether or not we're there just purely for entertainment, or whether we're there to prove a point or show off our technical abilities in solving the world's problems as well.
Well, I think ultimately, F1 needs, that's what I was saying, F1's at a crossroads, where my personal belief is it needs to perhaps accept the road relevance is less significant. Maybe Formula E with the powertrain development, every manufacturer believes, you know, electric is the immediate next future step we're all heading towards. So they use Formula E to be that development tool, that's fine. But then Formula One remains the pinnacle of our sport in terms of being the fastest, loudest, sexiest cars on the best tracks with the best drivers and our entertainment. Because it's sporting entertainment in the way that football or cricket or basketball, you know, none of these other things have anything to do with relevance in your life. There's sporting entertainment for you to watch and be entertained by. And I think where my train of thought slightly falls apart is obviously the capital required for motorsport is different to football or basketball. But ultimately, I think I think F1 is at that. It's on the precipice here of being. What does it want to be? It's, you know, it needs to work out its identity, really.
Ladies and gents, I've had the checkered flag sign, I'm afraid, from the back of the auditorium. So there is one more job we have to do. Thank you both. First off, for a very entertaining and keeping me entertained anyway. But before we go, raffle prize. You take one.
Okay. Can I just say thank you very much to the audience as well?
Yes.
And to you, Simon. Thank you for having me. Thank you very much. And to Carol.
This is first prize.
First prize, and what do they win?
They win a bag of goodies, including a very nice print of Niki Lauda in 1982.
All right, so if you've got a white ticket and it's number 99, well done. Congratulations.
We have one, yep, okay. And second prize, Corinne.
Number 53.
White
53. There we go.
There we go.
Got
it, wasn't the same person.
I'll do the last one, which is White 77, which I think is Valtteri Bottas, isn't it? Any winners? Yep. But if If the three of you could present yourselves with your tickets to Laura at the registration desk, she will sort you out with your goodies. Damon's already touched upon it, but I mean, thank you all of you for coming tonight. I hope they've entertained you. Thanks to Classic and Sports Finance for the support. Thanks to Steve for the Niki Lauda print. Thank you to all of you, and thank you particularly to you too. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Princess Yachts, the UK's leading luxury yacht manufacturer, proud sponsors of Motorsports Formula One coverage.